This podcast contains coarse language, adult themes, and spoilers.
My name's Peach, and for the past couple of years, I've been helping my friend Shag overcome his childhood aversions to everyday foods in the podcast Fussy Eater. Now it's his turn to help me conquer my phobia of scary movies over one spooky night in the FBI studios, one Wikipedia synopsis at a time. This is Spooko.
This has turned into almost an American podcast hosted from Australia, right? Which means that there are some fun facts and little footnotes and little bits of briefing that we have to do from time to time. We've spoken about beach privilege before. A commanding percentage of Australians, as Shag has told us, live within 50 k's of an excellent beach. There's another element that I think will be recognisable to long-term Spooko listeners that is a really poisonous Australian work ethic, right? And listeners to Spooko will be familiar with the fact that Shag and I hear rain, hail or shine. There was a classic commercial through the 1990s and into the 2000s for cold and flu tablets that essentially is like legal pseudoephedrine, right? It's the Breaking Bad drug that you have to drive around all the different suburbs and show your driver's license to. And the line was soldier on, right? Because the honorable and correct thing to do was to come to work and soldier on when you were feeling bad, because that's what you're meant to do as part of the poisonous Australian work ethic. There's this line young Australian lawyers are given of like, oh, people love Australian lawyers in London because they work so hard. They get straight into a job in some big firm in London. They just work, work, work. And what's interesting, Shag, is that with the benefit of time, I realize that capitalism has done it again. that essentially all these messages are, hey, don't worry about rest. Hey, don't worry about the value of your time. Just work more than you would otherwise be prepared to work, because that's just a good thing to do and it's just what you should do. And so, Shag, here we are. I'm not feeling 1,000,000% good. Got a couple of young golden children nearby who are feeling not 1,000,000% good. But the prospect of not recording a podcast when there's absolutely no real genuine obligation or anything arising from it just simply doesn't arise. So here we are, poisonous Australian work ethic in tow, reflecting on the capitalist message that's been delivered to us of good people work, including for no extra money. So, Shag, are you getting any extra money your end you haven't told me about? If not, then that's good. But if so, please share. But here we are, ready to do Spooko, despite the fact my voice sounds a little bit codrally.
Sexier. Your voice sounds even sexier.
It's mainly from blokes. I hear that I've got a sexy voice, right? heterosexual blokes. And so, I think sexiness is such a culturally specific thing, right? So, a certain outfit that confirms to contemporary style, you might say, oh, that attracts me. Whereas if someone was wearing a style from 10 years ago, you'd be like, oh, that doesn't attract me. So, look, I'll take sexier, Shag, but I note that you're a, cisgendered heterosexual bloke, and it is from such genders and such people that I tend to get this compliment. I'll still accept it with gratitude.
You know what's funny is I gave you a really clear out for today's episode as well. When, you're talking about our work ethic, you run your own business right now. You essentially set your own hours. I was like, hey, look, we can record tomorrow or the next day. But you were like, no way. We have an imaginary goal to set, which is to record the episode today. And I don't think, I think that's the toxic work ethic, which isn't necessarily related to quality. It's just you have to soldier on. You have to show up, right? It's not we need to make the best stuff. It's like we just need to show
something.
Up. You know, we need taking a sick day should make you feel guilty, essentially.
Yeah, you should be being sick, you should be doing work on your sick day. Yeah, absolutely.
There's been a weird cultural movement over the past couple of years where everyone's like, hey, maybe you shouldn't feel guilty for taking a sick day, which is wild. And maybe that's all global thing. Maybe that's not just an Australian thing.
I understand it to be a generational thing where, like, Shag, as you and I were making our way in professional life, I was like, oh, staying back late, like, oh, doing work over the weekend, like, of course. And, you know, working with people of a younger generation, they're like, oh, I'd probably prefer not to stay back too late or do work over the weekend. It's like, oh, I used to do stuff like that. Surely you should just want it, and you shouldn't make me feel bad for asking it from you.
You know what? That's so funny. It is. You're just abuse begets abuse, and yep. We're just trying to perpetuate a cycle, and yeah. I'm kind of loving how much, you know, we talked about Gen Z last week, how much Gen Z are really trying to break all of these toxic cycles we've built up for them over generation after generation.
Are we the worst generation? Like, I feel that we've got the worst of, like, boomer selfishness and asset hoarding, and we've got the worst of sort of self-focused younger generations, and we've got it with none of the grace of some of elements of the boomer generation and none of the generosity and self-reflexiveness of the younger generations. I feel like we may be the, what's the opposite of the apex? We may be the fucking bottom of the pile of all the generations.
Is it Nadir?
Nadir, yes, Shag.
I think it is. Yes. I think it is. I agree, and I don't think it's the millennials' fault when you look at the content we were served in our formative years. Mm. So, Peach, I'm getting to the film we're covering today.
Yes.
Because I think it's one of the worst films. No, maybe, you know what? I'm just going to say it. I'm not going to. This is the worst film we've covered in sequel season so far.
Okay, let's go.
This is a 2002 film from that era where all culture was kind of ironic. Everything was sort of, you know, we talk about the monoculture now where everything's trying to feed an algorithm. Back then, everything was sort of, is it ironic? Isn't it? Do we like this? Don't we? Is this funny? Isn't it? We don't know. That kind of typifies content from the early noughties. And more than anything, it was just lazy. So when we talk about the spooko work ethic, it always comes back to a key tenet of this pod. Like, yes, we are slaves to this generational work ethic that's been instilled in us. But on the other side, we like making good stuff.
Yes.
We believe in creating good things, and we know that showing up each week helps us create something, create a community, create a pod, create a show that is worthwhile culturally.
There's all these shit business books that I've read during my life, and they always retell the same anecdotes. And it's occasionally by, like, here's
how.
Do they
really always retell the same anecdotes?
Hugely. they always do. And, you know, partly it's like the way the SEALs killed Osama bin Laden is the way, you know, the SEAL, whoever it was, is the way that you should prepare for your next pitch or whatever. And the other version of, like, the other story that's often told is something that really does sound made up of, like, it's a photography course, right? And the professor divided the class in half, and they said, this half of the class, your job is just to take 100 photographs this semester, and this half of the class, your job is just to take one photograph that's the best you can possibly do. Do you know what's interesting? That as the years passed, the half of the class that took 10 photos a week and, like, gradually got better at their craft, by the end of the term, their photos were so much better than the half of the class who just had to sit there and think and really refine and try to focus on just taking one photo. And it really makes you think about whether taking 100 photos is better than taking one photo. There we go. And it's like, there is some kernel of truth there, right, of, like, repetition of something will likely make you better at it. But I do feel like it's an anecdote that's leaned on a little too heavily. Jack, can you just excuse me a moment? Because I'm going to come back with even better internet. I'm going to apply my work ethic to things that I feel bad about domestically. It's going to be good. Jack, you'd have an ear for AI music, right? So, you know, you're like Vivaldi's Four Seasons Winter Drill version. Strikes me as you're, like, definitive, like, a computer made this sort of bullshit. And you're, like, Moonlight Sonata or whatever into whatever that Dr. Dre instrumental is. Like, what is that? That's a dum 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 blim 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 blim. And I've forgotten what the dray beat is at that tempo, but you probably remember better than I do. Do you find you've got an ear for that? You're just like, nah, there was no human hands touched this, no human brain touched this.
Not at all. It's really tricky at the moment because AI visual and AI video were sort of the first cabs off the rank when it came to generated content. But now AI voice and AI music is rolling out and I don't know, it's indistinguishable to production music, which was already pretty bland and soulless and trying to feed, the needs of people based on what's come before rather than a spark of inspiration. So, yeah, it's tricky at the moment.
So, the playlist of, beats to study to or whatever, it's, whoever's making money off that, sadly, that's,
well, that's the time it, right? has come. Well, yeah, exactly, exactly, exactly. Now, if this segue into content feels weird, Peach obviously just went and fixed the internet in his house.
Did some work ethic household admin. That's good.
Middle of the pod. And now we're back and we can't really remember what happened. But Peach, let me explain. Okay, so
we're in the early noughties. It's a weird time for culture. Are we earnest? Are we ironic? Yes, let's do it.
So this is where this film's from. And I guess to round out my point before I introduce the film is that we believe in we believe in working to make good things.
Yes.
So for me, the work ethic here serves a purpose because we want Spooko to be a good pod. We want the Nightmare Method to be good. We like creating good things. We enjoy that. We get fulfillment from that. So it sucks when you watch a film that's so unbelievably lazy that it's not even bad in the sense that they took a swing and a miss and, whoa, a lot of these choices did not pay off. It's bad because they just did not care. And I want to give you one clear example of this. Obviously, this is a spoiler for what happens in the story, but who fucking gives a shit? So
not you. I'm getting that very strongly.
So later in the film, Mila Kunis, who is the main antagonist in this film, speaks to a psychologist, and the psychologist says to, now, number one, this is lazy plotting anyway, but the psychologist is like, you're still alive? I thought you hung yourself. And she says, no, I didn't hang myself. And just the fact that the script writers didn't even pick up the fact that hung obviously is the wrong word. The right terminology should have been, I thought you hanged yourself. I thought you hung yourself, right? Like, that's just something that somebody, if there was a chain of creative oversight, would have picked up and been like, oh, that's the wrong word. Just change that word. The fact that no one did, and then in the room, they said that to tape, and the directors and everyone were like, oh, who fucking cares? Yeah, sure, that's fine. Let's move on to the next scene.
We got it.
That just typifies how fucking terrible this film is. So, Peach, today on the pod, we are doing the worst film in sequel season so far. The 2002 sequel to an incredibly feel-bad
scary
club
movie.
Classic, American Psycho 2.
I was not expecting you to say American Psycho. Okay, let's go.
But Pete, also, oh my God, this is it, Pete. I think it's really important. I'm going to send this to you. It's really important you watch the trailer I saw. So, because this is...
Okay.
Not only is this...
Can you text it to me?
Yeah, I'm going to try and text it to you. So, not only is this the worst film we've done in sequel season, I think this might be one of the worst trailers we've ever seen on Spooko. And I'm excited to edit in the audio. So, Peach, I'm going to text this to you now. Give me 1 second.
Can I just do a quick recap of American Psycho 1 as I recall it and understand it? Or maybe we'll do that after the promo.
We'll do that after the promo.
I Googled something you told me about 15 years ago yesterday, and I'd forgotten about it in the intervening 15, 20 years. Do you remember telling me that MTV had a program of, coaching you to become... like your dream, sort of like wish granting of like youth always wanted to be on the high school basketball team. Well, we've got an NBA coach who's going to coach you for 4 weeks and then it's going to be tryouts and you're an unpopular person in a basketball school. Don't worry. We're going to give you we're going to make you a basketball player. I think it's called like MTV's Make Me or something.
Yes.
You told me one about, I want to be a freestyle rapper. I want to be a rapper. And the coach they got was C-Ray's Walls. Do you remember C-Ray's Walls from like Def Jux Records? With friends with LP and Aesop Rock and stuff. He had that great song like Buck 80. Firstly, I couldn't find the episode of the MTV show or even what it was called because I was like, I'd love to see C-Ray's Walls trying to teach someone to freestyle. But secondly, like every single rap song from 20 years ago, like it's homophobic. Mm. It's like really gender essentialist.
So it's so true.
It's got like, I'm like, oh, this guy's a pretty like, you know, rapping on your block type energy. And I'm like, oh my God. Then even listening to like an old Jay-Z song, it's like from 2002, he's like, my dick game's vicious. I'm like, that's like, I'm like, they're like, I don't even, like, that doesn't make sense, but also to the extent it does, it's really bad. Like, it's just not a good thing to say.
But I also never know who those lines are for. Like, I feel like when you're, you know, you don't have to make art for the audience at all, right? But,
yeah, okay.
But sometimes it's worth considering, okay, someone's at home listening on headphones, like, what do I take from that? What do I do with that?
Let's say it's a brag to the effect of, I'm a great lover, right? I'm a great lover, and that's the brag. And, like, I just find, like my dick game, so, like, the way I put my penis to use when we're having sex, it's like, okay, cool. That's, yeah, that's what you're saying is your, like, special skill. But I do feel like vicious is just a really, in any case...
Okay.
Let's watch this trailer, shall we? Should we watch the trailer?
New card. What do you think?
Whoa. Very nice.
He was the most notorious serial killer of his time.
So what do you do?
I'm into, murders and executions mostly.
Oh, my God. Can I just pause? Like, I think we're down with saying, like, Bret Easton Ellis is a fucking idiot. Does he really call mergers and acquisitions murders and executions?
Yeah. And look, we will talk about the original American Psycho afterwards. You just got to keep watching the trailer.
It's been entirely the first film so far.
With an almost perfect track record.
Do you have any witnesses or fingerprints?
Actually, yes.
Now, the one that got away is picking up where he left off. American Psycho continues. Angrier. Deadlier. And sexier than ever before.
Angrier, deadlier, sexier. I do think tonally... That's just bizarre to watch in that initially we just saw a highlight reel and presumably we're seeing a sibling of Patrick Bateman or someone who witnessed something or whatever. And Mila Kunis is the high school version, the femme high school version of Patrick Bateman. I thought the fundamental point of American Psycho was its ambiguity. I thought you ended the book and the film with the character kind of dissembling and like half recognizing some people in a restaurant or something and being like, oh, hang on, we've confused one person for another person. Oh, maybe all this is all made up. I thought the point was we leave the film knowing Bateman is so hollow and untrustworthy that it may be none of the murders happened and nothing in the film took place. And it strikes me this movie is like everything was real in American Psycho. There was zero ambiguity, and here's the next one. Even angrier, even sexier.
So, Peach, this film typifies the dark side of horror film sequel culture. And to get there, I want to start with American Psycho. So we've talked about this book in the pod. I think it was a formative influence on me appreciating horror, for good or bad, because I read it at an early age and probably an age where I wasn't able to properly process it. So I've spoken before about how it's, you know, the book is by far the most extreme, explicit piece of media I've ever been exposed to. And we've done multiple episodes about, you know, the most disturbing films of all time. And I haven't watched half of them, but I've studied them to the point where I know what happens in them. And nothing compares to American Psycho. It's a few things, right? Like, it's ostensibly a satire on consumption and the 80s sort of green is good atmosphere. To your point as well, it's very dreamlike. You never know if what's happening is real. And to that point about murders and executions, there's a through line in the novel and the film where Patrick Bateman will tell anyone who will listen that he murders people and no one takes him seriously. Or they don't believe him, or maybe it didn't happen. We never really know for sure. And, you know, look, fine, it's a satire, but it's not just a satire, and it can't just be a satire because it has this endlessly deep pit of visceral and sometimes sexual violence that the book talks about in the most graphic detail possible, in between whole chapters dedicated to Patrick Bateman's opinion on a Whitney Houston album or a Huey Lewis and the News album. And the thing that you come away from after reading that book is not, you're not like, wow, he's evil. It's the emptiness of his psychopathy, of his narcissism. The fact that it's all meaningless. It doesn't mean anything to him. And like, that's by far the scariest thing, the way it's described in such a detached manner, you know. And we talk about Bret Easton Ellis. This book clearly had an effect on him, right? Like, I don't think he's ever been the same since writing and releasing this novel. I think he even wrote, like, I went through a big Bret Easton Ellis phase as well as, you know, a Stephen King phase during my, like, horror novel journeys. And he writes a follow-up book. I can't remember what it's called. Maybe it's called Echo Park or something. It's a novel where essentially he plays Bret Easton Ellis and he's haunted by the ghost of Patrick Bateman, right? Like, it's, you know, no one who was involved in the making of that will ever be the same. But then they turn it into a film with Christian Bale, who we know because we're the boring dude versions of a basic bitch, and we love Christopher Nolan. And we know that Christian Bale is a phenomenal actor. And he becomes Patrick Bateman in such a way that this film becomes both a hit and a cult hit because it's a horror film. And all the Fat Cat studio heads who own the rights to these things get dollar signs in their eyes.
Well, it's his defining role as well for like a huge movie star who's super accomplished and super talented and has done a fair few things in the 25 years since American Psycho was released. I still think it would be his most notable role, maybe a bit of Batman, but probably not, I'd say.
And I mean, there's lots of evidence that the younger generations, you know, the younger side of Gen Z, so, you know, the 16 to 18-year-olds are really getting into this film and are so far removed from the context of it and the novel itself, I imagine. So they just see it as this fun, crazy slasher about like an evil psychopath. But anyway, so this is this film and this novel and this story and this character with such a crazy legacy. But because it was popular, the fat cats behind the studio, and this is why I talk about the dark side of horror sequel making, is there's no concern, there's no reverence to the subject matter, the film, what it meant to people. They basically were like, we need a sequel. So they found a screenplay for a film originally entitled The Girl Who Wouldn't Die, which might be the worst title for anything I've ever heard.
Oh, my God.
And look, like, and when it's just lazy. Like, I am calling you out because that is a bad title. And I know it's bad because you didn't try hard enough.
I did my best.
You didn't do your best. That's the thing. You definitely didn't do your best because that is a bad title, right? So there was this screenplay called The Girl Who Wouldn't Die. Originally had no association with American Psycho, but after production began. So production had already begun on this film. The script was altered to connect the film with the original. American Psycho 2 was released direct to video on June 18, 2002. It was later denounced by Bret Easton Ellis, the author of the original novel, and Kunis later expressed regret for being in the film.
Oh, God. So this is very much those, like, in the rhythm of those Disney straight-to-DVD sequels of, like, Aladdin 2, Genie's Christmas Adventure or whatever of like of like Lion King 2 Scar's Adventure or whatever. Yeah. Yeah, okay, I'm with you. It's very much cobbled together, slapped together in a slapdash kind of way. I do find it challenging when people disown works of creativity they've been involved in at the time. And I can imagine doing that, of being like, no, ideally I wouldn't have done that, or like, hey, I no longer stand behind that. And I think I'm in support of people having that self-reflexivity, but it does make me feel awkward, you know, to sort of say, hey, well, you, to an extent, I think you've got to be held to the deal you struck, to the deal Bret Easton Ellis struck, to use the name for the, you know, American Psycho 2. He could have done his diligence on that, or the, you know, the ambition Mila Kunis had to become a known actor, including by accepting this role. I'm big on people being able to apologize and being able to sort of acknowledge things and move past it, including because I've done stuff that I want to apologize for and move past. But I do feel slightly awkward of like, nah, that wasn't that cool. Now that the culture doesn't really appreciate it, or now that I've seen the final version, I say, actually, no, it sucks. When it was in my power to change it at various times, I find that awkward.
So this film was, and, you know, I feel bad for the director, but also, like, I mean, so Peach, if your name was Liam Hemsworth.
Yeah.
I feel like we
same voice. Yeah.
But I mean, you'd call yourself L. Hems or something, right? Like, so you'd find a way to not try to, I guess, steal valor from a famous name. So this was directed This was directed by a guy called Morgan J. Freeman. And look, I feel bad for a director who doesn't even have a filmography section in their Wikipedia bio.
Oh, come on.
And what's rough is Morgan's first film won all these awards at Sundance, and then it was kind of all downhill from there. And I, like I said, you can make one great thing, and that's enough. And that is enough. That you can make one
surely
great
thing. Surely you just go MJ Friedman.
Yeah, MJ Friedman.
Like, surely that's, yeah. Like, they really need to get, like, before people choose the names that they're going to go by as directors in 2002, they really need to run it past
They really do.
I'm looking forward to tangling with this film, especially for that issue you raised earlier that you've also described in the past, I think, as generational, as to whether this is an earnest film where we're seeing what really happened, or whether we're, like, ironically arching our eyebrows as we're watching along. Interesting.
I also think, you know, going back to that AI conversation, we're pretty close to inviting an AI guest who is Morgan J. Freeman and Mila Kunis at the time of writing this, you know, creating this film, and just asking them questions about it.
AI Gordon Ramsay will be appearing in probably season 2 of The Nightmare Method, I should expect.
Bloody hell.
At least in text form.
Bloody hell. At least somebody's enjoying this podcast. All right. Okay, all right, okay. Let's do this fucking film, okay. So, in 1993, a 12-year-old...
He'll have the biggest dick on the podcast. And it'll be vicious.
If it's drained on his autobiography, it will have a lot of that talk.
Yes. Yeah, it's really weird. Anyway, sorry, go.
That is also an in-joke for The Nightmare Method, which you should totally
listen to. Yeah, goes in The Nightmare Method... have you had a number of people who are Spooko listeners in the Feel Bad Club who are like, nah, should I listen to The Nightmare Method? And I'm like, yeah, like, yeah. It's like, I like Spooko, but I don't know. I'm like, it's pretty much the same thing.
We haven't even done a synopsis yet. I've read like a couple of words from the synopsis. We're like 40 minutes into
Soldier
this
on, Chag. Soldier on. Let's do it.
Okay. All right. Okay. In 1993, a 12-year-old girl accompanies her babysitter on a date with serial killer Patrick Bateman. After Bateman kills and starts to dissect the babysitter, the girl kills him with an ice pick.
Hang on. The girl kills Bateman?
Yes.
So, in 1993 or whatever?
Yeah. In this film, to your point, in this film, Patrick Bateman was a serial killer who murdered and dissected women primarily.
Okay.
And he is killed by a 12-year-old girl who is the daughter of his date for the night. Now, we know all this because this film employs two of the laziest devices you can use in storytelling.
Flashbacks
and narration. So not only do we have flashbacks through this film, we have Mila Kunis constantly narrate what she's thinking, what she's feeling, what's happening. So as the audience, we're never unsure of what's happening.
I thought the point was, like, the point of the first film is for us to feel sort of all at sea and for us to be putting it together ourselves.
So this film
is like the anti-American Psycho 2.
Yeah, like, you know, to put it in the in terms of noughties filmmaking, this film somehow is a cross between Election, that Matthew Broderick and Reese Witherspoon vehicle, and the Ocean's 11 franchise.
Well, that sounds fun. No, I don't know. I'm actually having fun hearing that. Right. But imagine if that wasn't fun.
Imagine if that sucked and you've got this film.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Yeah. 6 years later, the young girl, Rachel Newman, is now a college student studying criminology at a Washington university under Professor Starkman, a former FBI agent.
A lot of men's in the surname. Like, what's Mila Kunis' surname again?
Her name is Newman.
So Freeman directs Newman and was it Starkman?
He's definitely it is funny. So his name is Freeman, and whenever it comes time for names, it's like, what about something
with names have men at the end. So let's start there, right?
All right, okay, all right, okay. Now, Professor Starkman is this lecturer and he gave up being an FBI agent because the case.
Hang on, it's Patrick Bateman as well.
Yeah, it's Patrick Bateman as well.
Hang on. So, like, the Moon surname energy is really strong in this.
Names are hard.
It's like, what classic things can we take from the first film? It's like surnames ending in Moon.
fuck. That is the energy. That is the energy of when you have to deliver a piece of work with, you know, within half an hour. And it's like, what the fuck could I cobble together? Like that is the surface level reading they have done of American Psycho. Okay, all right. Now, Professor Starkman gave up being an FBI agent because, and this isn't in the Wikipedia synopsis, or it's not in there yet, because he was trailing Patrick Bateman and because he was like a serial killer expert, but Patrick Bateman was the case that broke him.
Yes. Look, I even think that's fine. Yep, I'm down for that.
I also think, like, we talk about abuse begets abuse, and it kind of makes sense that somebody who witnessed something awful at 12 and then was forced to kill someone at 12 would go on to become a serial killer. That kind of makes sense, right?
I'm into this so far, at least structurally.
Yeah. We'll keep listening. All right. Okay. So
hold on to that thought. Yeah.
Rachel aspires to join the FBI and is determined to get the coveted teaching assistant position under Starkman, which would make her a shoo-in for the FBI training program in Quantico, Virginia, which I believe is like the FBI's headquarters.
Yeah, it's where Jody hung out with him during Silence of the Lambs. Would you accept a criminology student, Shag, into the FBI? Like, I expect that's kind of the last thing, or it's the last place you look, I imagine, if you're recruiting for the FBI.
Actually, hang on, why is that? Wouldn't you want to, like, have people who, like, studied criminology?
So, criminology, you know, I studied criminology. It was more about the, like, demography of crime and, like, intersections of power and understanding policy issues and that sort of thing. It wasn't like the committing of crime. Like, let's start. Like, it's not like studying crimes.
So wait. Because that is what happens in these lectures. Are you telling me that Morgan J. Freeman somehow let the wrong name for a whole field of education slide into this script unchecked?
Oh, so sorry. So the criminology lectures are like, you'll never believe what the Blogsy Strangler used to do.
Yes.
What? Oh, God. So essentially it's a true crime podcast course. Essentially he's just doing true crime.
Yes, because every class is like, did you know that Ted Bundy used to like eat his victims? And then
what's even the exam on that? What have you learnt on that? I'm like, it's pretty crazy. You guys ever hear of Ted Bundy?
Okay. Can you imagine if the question was, have you...
The exam's like a pub trivia night, essentially.
Have you guys ever heard of Ted Bundy? Oh, God, I'm crying. Oh, fuck. Okay, all right, okay, all right, all right. Okay. After Secretary Gertrude Fleck rudely dismisses Rachel's application for the teaching position on the basis that she's a freshman, Rachel follows her home, puts her cat in the microwave. When she goes to check on the cat, she's like, what the hell? Somebody put my cat in the microwave. She bludgeons her to death. Also, a lot of the deaths in this film happen off screen, so it can't even commit to like having a little bit of gory fun for the gore hounds.
So. What do we know about this cat? Like, I thought she was an ambitious young potential FBI.
Yeah, so she's like, well, this is like, you know, some admin assistant is essentially like, yeah. Oh, you can't apply for this position because you're too young. So she goes and kills her.
But isn't that like four steps away from even commencing her goal?
Yeah.
It's like not being put through to the correct phone number or something. It's like, surely.
The whole point of Patrick Bateman style characters is they're so lacking in empathy that it's very easy for them to put those steps together in their mind of exactly what they need to do to get there, because there's nothing stopping them. And so her just, you know, reactively murdering people is so off, you know, out of character for a film psychopath that it kind of blows my mind. But Peach, I think you're starting to see the laziness of this film.
Okay.
Determined to succeed, Rachel proceeds to kill off any of her peers that stand as competition, starting with Brian Leeds, whom she drugs and murders during a proposed sexual encounter. And this has one of the good moments of the film, in which he lies down on her bed while she goes to get a condom. And he like feels something weird or hears something weird on the bed, looks underneath, and there's like plastic covering the bottom mattress.
Yes.
And he's a bit like, that's a bit weird. And then finds an ice pick and he's like, why does she have an ice pick next to her? And then she strangles him to death.
Oh.
Yeah. And all to like a noughties soundtrack of songs that were
like Block Party.
Well, no, like an early naughty soundtrack. So something out of, like an American Pie soundtrack. It's so tonally weird.
Oh, okay. Like some 41, like I'm in too deep and I'm trying to keep.
I mean, not quite. Like, I don't even know how to describe it. It's just, it's not, like, I don't know what to make of this film. It's so lazy that a lot of the choices don't even make sense.
Does she comment on the music at any time, Patrick Bateman style? like Sum 41 and Avril Lavigne would have been Sum 41 bloke.
I mean, that's another really good point. Like, music was such a conscious choice in American Psycho. Yeah, anyway, let's, okay. Next, she murders Keith Lawson, a bookish classmate, while he studies late one night in the university library.
So Keith Lawson's surname, it's not Lawman, right? But also, like, what she's studying is pretty much, like, this film wants us to believe it's pretty adjacent to, like, law enforcement. So, like, this, like, even the surname of Law, I'm like, did they have 1 second to name all these characters? like, fuck. We've already done 3 months. We'll do a sim.
All right. During her killing spree, Rachel decides to see the school psychiatrist, Dr. Eric Daniels. Now, after one session, he realizes that Rachel is a textbook sociopath. Which...
Mm-hmm. Well, but like a textbook sociopath would manipulate the therapist into not realizing that.
Right? Like, it doesn't make any sense. And none of the choices in this film make sense. But let's keep going. A textbook sociopath that is obsessed with Starkman So Daniels tries to warn Starkman without revealing. I've got to get to this point. So Daniels tries to warn Starkman without revealing Rachel's name due to patient confidentiality. So.
Because
I got to tell you this exchange, right? he's like the campus psychiatrist or psychologist or whatever. He calls up Dr. Starkman and he's like, hey, I need to warn you about one of your students who has just become a patient of mine. And Dr. Starkman's like, aren't you breaching patient confidentiality? And then he goes, well, yes and no. So tell you what, I won't tell you their name. I'll just say someone is with these characteristics.
Yeah, a little bit of this, a little bit of that.
This film just pisses me off so much.
Anyway. I love that it's like in for a penny but out for a pound. Of like, are you breaching? It's like, no, I won't. I'll only partially breach.
All right, okay. Starkman mistakenly assumes that the student obsessed with him is Cassandra Blair, with whom he is carrying on an extramarital affair. And one of the worst parts of this is that he's played by William Shatner and an elderly, you know, even in 2002, he was an older guy, and she's like young woman. And they're having this affair, and the way it's treated by the director is, oh, like, she's in love with him. And she's like, he's so sexy. And he's like, I think even at one point, she references to him having, like, a really great dick. And it's just, it's so dangerous having an uninterrogated character like that or relationship like that in a film like this to an audience of young people.
I couldn't agree more. Like, a 19-year-old is more or less a 7-year-old, like, in my eyes. And to a very sophisticated, experienced adult who wields power over these people
direct power.
Absolute influential over the life of their career. If they want to join the FBI, you better become one of my students. Just to leave that totally unexamined, maybe that's the real horror of this film, Shag. Peach. Copyright.
So when Rachel finds out, Cassandra reveals that her affair with Professor Starkman has guaranteed her the teaching assistant position. So Rachel decides to murder her as well, staging her death as a suicide. And she does this by hanging her in her room with a note taped to her chest.
Being like, "Fourth, I'm bummed out."
Like, it's, and like, obviously that's entirely insensitive, but also so ridiculously, like, you know, like, I imagine there was no sensitivity training around creating this scene either.
Like, death by suicide is something you have to be so careful with. This film obviously was.
She then confesses her crime.
Sorry, and I should just acknowledge and accept that this was not death by suicide, so that's not what's being portrayed.
Yeah, exactly. So she then goes to Professor Starkman, confesses her crimes to him, her crush on him, crush in inverted commas, according to Wikipedia, and that she knew about his affairs with various women, which included her former babysitter that Bateman murdered,
Okay, well, but if we flash back ourselves to the year 1992 or whatever, so we have the impossible coincidence that Starkman, who is hunting Bateman, is also dating the murder victim of Bateman's.
Yes.
Whose murder leads to Bateman's death. And then the witness and killer of Bateman later becomes a student of his. That is an absolutely impossible coincidence.
As he backs up towards the window in a state of confusion and fear, Rachel blows him.
How does he stumble out the window?
Rachel blows him a kiss and he falls out the window to his death. As she leaves, Rachel also murders a janitor and security guard because they witnessed Starkman's death.
But she didn't kill Starkman.
On the last day of classes before spring break, Rachel's parents make a surprise visit to her at her dormitory. She quickly ushers them out, agreeing to meet with them for dinner later that night. That same night, while treating his elderly mother to a night out, the psychiatrist Daniels observes Rachel with her parents at a local restaurant. Daniels becomes suspicious since he believed Rachel was dead, which is when we have the line of him going up to her and being like, I thought you hung yourself. And she's like, no, I didn't. I didn't hang myself. Like,
and it's like, yeah, like, I'm right here.
But also, yeah, like, could you imagine? He, and he's, a, like, he should not.
Surely he's had sensitivity training, right? So if he actually genuinely thought that she was entertaining suicidal thoughts, then as her therapist, to, like, confront her and be like, not dead, hey? Mm.
I know. That's so, okay, all right, okay.
This film like collapses in on itself.
No, so after dinner, he goes to the local police station to ask the police officers about any recent missing persons cases, to which the police are like, yeah, let me show you all of our files.
Yeah, oh yeah, missing persons. Yeah, okay.
Through a flashback, it is revealed that Rachel is in fact an imposter who killed the real Rachel at the beginning of the semester and assumed her identity, storing the real Rachel's corpse in a garment bag in her dormitory closet. And we know this because we have a scene where Rachel opens the closet and there's heaps of flies and she's like, wow, you stink. And then we see the corpse.
Didn't Rachel's parents visit?
Well, there's that. We know this because the psychiatrist calls her Rachel, and the parents are like, "Why did they call her by a different name? That's weird." But then do nothing with that.
Hang on. But isn't it the dead student's parent? Like, are we out to dinner with the dead student's parents?
No. We're out to dinner with Mila Kunis's character's parents, who think.
Okay, sorry.
But she's at college now under the assumed identity of Rachel Newman, and the parents, like.
Oh, my God. So her new life, like, her new character in her new life is actually called Newman.
But also, what I, like, you've, yes. But also, you've assumed an identity, like, a new identity. You essentially assumed a dead person's identity, but you're still hanging out with your original identity's parents. Like, it's just not very good serial killer behavior. And she's in criminology class learning about how serial killers do it.
What Ted Bundy got up to or whatever. Does she have a genuine ambition to work for the FBI? Like, or does that just sort of fall away just once the plot gets rolling?
Well, there's one moment where she proves how good she is because someone's like, Ted Bundy was a methodical killer. And she's like, actually, that's not true. And everyone in the class is like, what? And she's like, towards the end, one of his victims was a bit sloppy. And it's like, to your point, that proves you've listened to a true crime podcast.
But why would you set your film in a university if you don't understand what education is? Or you don't remember what it is? It's just so weird.
Anyway,
it's as if the university course is just like trivia, just fun trivia. Like, hey, Shag, it's fun trivia day today. We're going to learn some more fun stuff. We need some stories.
Wait. This is the best line. The real Rachel was an orphan, so when Rachel claimed to be her, there was no one to disprove her claim because she doesn't have parents.
Yeah. And it's only parents, like, and that's it. You're alone in the world. Your parents are dead. That's the end.
No one can tell who you are.
Yeah, that's it.
Everyone's like, who are you? Okay, all right, okay. Daniels and two cops pursue Rachel in a car chase because obviously she's got a couple of corpses in her car, which ends with Rachel driving off a cliff, resulting in the car exploding. At this point, she is presumed dead.
Nice.
2 years later, yes. Dr. Daniels is giving a lecture on Rachel's mind and how he wrote a book about her. And he called the book One in a Billion. And he ends the talk by being like, she truly was one in a billion.
One in a billion. Oh, and that's it.
No, wait. It gets worse.
I want her having a Fernet Branca and making eye contact with Michael Caine. Be like,
You won't have to talk to me. I won't have to talk to you. Or whatever.
I won't bury another member of the Wade family. I won't do it. This is my resignation letter. All right. Okay. So
was it you who told me about the trip where they do the like the Batman off?
There are. It's kind of a Michael Caine off, but there are so many people who pass off that impersonation, but literally the words they use in that impersonation as their Michael Caine impression. Like, it's wild how influential that scene in that movie has become.
Just, like, referring to it, it's like, I've already buried so many Batmans. I'm not burying any more Batmans.
So, all right, okay. So, after his lecture, he's signing his novel that somehow has become the hottest novel in the world. So, he's signing his book, not a novel. He's signing his true crime book. It's become the hottest book in the world. When he looks up from speaking with a student to see Rachel.
Blonde wig.
Who has not dyed it. Blonde wig. She looks pretty much the same. She's wearing glasses. Who has not dyed at all. She indirectly reveals that she killed Starkman's last assistant, Elizabeth McGuire, and stole her identity to get into Quantico FBI Academy. She allows Dr. Daniels to know because in her narration, she believes there's no point in committing the perfect crime if no one knows about it, and she is confident that he will not divulge this information because it would make a farce of his best-selling book in which he claimed to completely understand her and witness her death in the fiery car, which makes no sense because if you wrote a book about a one-in-a-million psychopath who died in a car crash and then you found out she wasn't even dead and she's like, that's the sequel.
It proves the book was a great idea. Like, it's like the best possible marketing for the book imaginable and also the sequel to the book. And also, I'm pretty sure Lizzie McGuire was a popular TV show at the time, going there really scraping the bottom of the barrel with names.
Yes, yes.
They started off at the bottom of the barrel.
The body that was in the car was the real Rachel, whose decaying body had been kept in the killer's dorm closet. It was revealed by another student that Rachel is the youngest agent to be drafted into the bureau in her sophomore year. As Rachel walks out of the class, Dr. Daniels is visibly shaken by what he has just learned. And so that's the end of the film. But I need to point out the way he finds this out is the next person who asks for the book to be signed. He's like, you know, Dr. Daniels is so shook. He's like, do you know that girl? And he's like, what? Agent McGuire? Who's the youngest, hippest, coolest, sexiest FBI agent in the history of the force? Yeah, I know who she is. It's like, American Psycho 2, Peach.
So, if we were to speak in this film's defense, what would you say it was about?
Like I said, it's a heist movie, so it's the perfect crime, but also mixed with, you know, Reese Witherspoon's character from Election, who was just had a endless drive for success, which ruffled the feathers of those around her.
But her drive for success at the FBI, like, I don't see a through line to these various murders, such as to the admin person who's one of the early murders. A through line from there to the FBI.
But also, he has made, not only would this have been like a major crime that everyone would have talked about, right? Like, you know, 8 murders, dies in a fiery crash, crazy stuff, right? Not only that. Someone writes a true crime book about her. So I'm guessing her photo would be in the public consciousness. People would know what she looks like.
If you're like one in a billion, wow, who's one in a billion?
Right? And then she doesn't change her appearance to join the FBI. Who would have so much like facial recognition technology?
And who would be the first buyers of the book? Yeah. They'd be like, sick, this is the exact kind of stuff we do. Love to read this book.
Criminology class.
In fact, sorry, because Starkman, the direct path to joining the FBI is through Starkman.
Yeah.
So you're going to be the first buyer of this book.
And also keep in mind, I'm pretty sure Elizabeth McGuire had already been accepted to the FBI. So somehow She assumed her identity looking completely different, and the FBI was like, well, you've got the same name, so it must be you.
And suggests, ironically, the FBI's powers of investigation and identifying people are very poor. I'm like, yeah, sounds good. Look, I enjoy dunking on it, but there's a degree where this really waters down. Like, if you were to accept this film as in any way worthwhile, and I'm not doing that necessarily, but if you were to say as a fun slasher or whatever, then the fact of its title and the fact that it purports to be canonical of Bateman, not like an alternate universe Bateman, it's like it's American Gothic, American
Psycho 2.
Psycho 2. What it does is damage the legacy of the initial film. The sort of, you know, much like the Matrix sequels, where like at the end of the first Matrix, you're like, "Oof, okay, sick. Looks like Neo's off to fight the machines." And then subsequent sequels were like, yeah, some machines are good, some machines are bad. It's all a bit messy. And then like later, it's like, oh, machines can have kids with like humans and stuff. And it's like, oh, like, okay, hang on. What are we even, like, what are we even talking about now? Whereas, yeah, the end of American Psycho, I think, is pretty crisp. Like, I'm not saying I particularly like it as a film, but it's kind of like, hey, you know, there's some pretty crazy stuff. What do you reckon? And you go, oh, yeah, that was pretty crazy. And then this is like, oh, yeah, all that stuff was completely true. And here's what happened next. I don't know. A little on the nose, Shay. A little on the nose. So, someone really should have had their codral that day.
So from that's a soldier on joke. So from the worst sequel we've covered in sequel season to one of the best.
Terminator 2.
One of the best horror sequels of the 80s. That's what we're covering next week. So stick around.
Are we doing Terminator 2 next week?
We're not doing Terminator 2.
Oh, okay. Can we do Terminator 2?
This was recorded at FBI Studios. Please like, subscribe, and follow wherever you can and as much as you can. And Resh's, what's up?
Should we watch the trailer? My trailer game's vicious. I don't even know what that means.
I almost spat out all my tea.